IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat. Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. As you know by now, we've recently published an edited volume based on our flagship New World Order project, aiming to understand how the world order is changing and what India needs to do about it. This book, called India's Marathon, Reshaping the Post-Pandemic World Order, brings together original chapters by a host of leading public intellectuals, experts, and practitioners to create a comprehensive vision of the future centered on India and for India watchers across the world. Today, we have with us another author for India's Marathon, Ameya Ashok Naik. Welcome, Ameya.
Hi, Anirudh. Good to be here.
Ameya does a lot of teaching for Takshashila, and he's got some fairly fantastic qualifications under his belt. He's both a lawyer and he's trained in diplomacy and conflict resolution from the Fletcher School. And Ameya has a fascinating chapter in India's Marathon about the case for a rules-based international order. Now, as I'm sure a lot of our listeners would already know, the great powers of the world aren't exactly known for upholding international law and order. And it seems that far more often you see countries like Russia and China flouting international law where it seems convenient to them. You, for example, see China extensively indulging in salami slicing tactics, especially along its border with India as well as in the South China Sea. We see Russia, for example, indulging in some fairly aggressive power plays in Eastern Europe, including, for example, the annexation of Crimea. And it very often seems that these great powers never really face any consequences for flouting international laws and norms like this. And this can very often lead to the question of what really is the point of these international laws if a powerful state can always break them and do whatever it wants. Ameya has some interesting views that which he presents through his chapter about why exactly India should care and what India's position should be on the question of adherence to international law. But first, let's try to understand the basic arguments. Why are international laws and norms important? How do they structure the way that states interact? How do they constrain state behavior? Over to you, Ameya. What are your thoughts?
Okay, so let's do this at two or three levels, right? First, at the global systems level. So one of the most common arguments that you'll hear made by people who advocate for the idea that there is no such thing as international law is that there is no all-powerful enforcing authority behind it. So in the way that the government or the state in a given country is actually the force or the sanction that backs the power of law, and it's because that force or that sanction lies behind it that the law actually is binding and effective, there's no parallel central power that can back an international law. The response to this, or the flaw in this argument, is on the one hand that, and we should know this quite well in India, right? The fact that there is a central power that is willing to lend force or sanction to the law is not in itself a guarantee that the law is going to be implemented, certainly not a guarantee that it's going to be implemented consistently and even-handedly, irrespective of the identity and the power of the people involved, right? We've seen object lessons on this every week, every day. You know, just cast your mind back to whatever the most recent example is. So that's one response. The other response is that any system of rules, and I'm using that word rules to encompass both things that are written down and signed onto, so laws and treaties and conventions, as well as things that are generally understood and abided by but not necessarily written down, so norms and customs. Any system of rules changes the probabilities of one's behavior. It does not guarantee a particular outcome. Someone can still choose at the end of the day to break a rule. But the more that there are strong rules against it, and the more that those rules are enforced, and the more that the penalty that stems from those rules is substantial, the less likely it makes it that somebody will choose to break those rules. So that's the global systems level argument, that it changes the probability of states' behavior. The more specific argument from the point of India as a player in this international system is that you have to consider where you stand in the hierarchy of power globally, right? And the lower that you find yourself on that hierarchy, the more it is in your interest for the rules to exist and for the rules to be strong and for the rules to be enforced, because those rules are actually an important part of your toolkit for protecting yourself or for constraining the behavior of stronger actors.
All right, but one could also argue that if you're a smaller state and you see that the global system isn't necessarily punishing powerful states that are messing with you in whatever way, right? So let's take the hypothetical example of a tiny country called A, which is neighbored by a very powerful country called B. And country B has a rather nasty habit of sending its fishermen into A's territorial waters. Now, A goes running to international courts. International courts fulminate mightily against country B and they deliver a judgment against it. But beyond that, they don't exactly do much to actually... they don't do much beyond a slap on the wrist for country B. As a result of which, why would country A continue to hold faith in these international rules and norms? Does it not make more sense that A might instead seek some kind of asymmetrical deterrent or that it might seek a more powerful ally than B, some other country C, to try and counterbalance its power?
Yeah, for sure. So none of these things are mutually exclusive, right? The weaker country in this case absolutely would seek some sort of asymmetrical deterrent or would seek some sort of alliance that could help it more closely enforce good behavior on the larger country's part, right? But on what basis would it approach or would it form that alliance? Possibly some form of shared interest. However, if this larger country doesn't have any particular shared interest with the smaller country, then on what basis is it going to form that alliance? And so the fact that there is, in fact, a judgment or some other basis or form for saying there is a violation of international law in this case, and as countries in this global order, we have a shared interest in making sure that those norms and those laws are upheld, it actually provides the larger country with a pretext for supporting the smaller one. It provides the smaller country with a basis for arguing, look, we know what you're really concerned about is the rise of this large country, because today they're messing with us, tomorrow they might mess with all of you as well. Maybe not in fishing, maybe they'll do it in something else, maybe they'll do it in technology research. But it is in your interest, larger countries, to make common cause with us on this particular issue, because here we can say that the law and the norms are on our side. And we can use this as one part of the system of pressure or containment that we want to bring to bear, right? So A, it creates a pretext. B, and this is where I want to go back to the argument about how is this different from domestic law. The courts in any given country do not enforce the law either, right? You know, the one country where the court had its own law enforcement wing, in the sense that it had people with arms that it could send to enforce its judgments, that would be Somalia, right? This was the Union of Islamic Courts in Somalia. What did the law enforcement wing of the Union of Islamic Courts in Somalia become? They became Al-Shabaab, right? There is a reason that we do not give courts enforcement authorities. Courts adjudicate. Courts say who is and who is not following the rules. After that, it's somebody else through some other means that enforces. Right, so just a lot of the arguments that are made about how this stuff is not actually enforced don't hold up to the comparisons to domestic law either.
That's an interesting point. So let's try to look at this from another angle, right? So we talked about how a smaller state might see a rules-based international system and perhaps use some of those rules and norms to kind of cajole larger states into helping it out. But what is the perspective of a larger state? Why would a superpower want to adhere to the norms that are established in the international sphere?
So, of course, this depends on whether this larger state or superpower believes that the rules are working in its favor or not. The explanation that I would provide is that that judgment is not made based on specific individual instances. It is made in the aggregate, right? So if you are the head of state of one of the world's superpowers, your mandate is not, listen, get this one fishing spot for your country's fishermen, right? Your mandate is the overall development and welfare and well-being and stability of your country as a whole. In general, a stable global political and military order contributes to this overall well-being, right? So for a large state, the benefit of a rules-based international order is that it injects predictability into an otherwise anarchic world. Unless you are so confident in your strength that you believe that you can successfully impose your will in every instance, in every place, and you have such a wealth of resources that you are willing to commit them to this project into perpetuity, you would actually much rather prefer having a set of agreed upon rules. And you only really have to step in the cases where there are divergence from or violations of those rules. So for a larger country, the existence of a rules-based international order helps them conserve resources. It helps them conserve not least the amount of like mind space and modeling that leaders and policymakers have to do. And it helps them focus on the specific few actors and few issues that are contentious, while being reasonably comfortable and assured that other stuff will carry on in keeping with the agreed rules and norms.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think that we see this idea that other states are constrained and therefore will act according to certain patterns very well in the way that China conducts its foreign policy, right? And it's somewhat ironic in my view, because China, while freely flouting international norms in some cases, also goes out of its way to kind of promote its own ideas of what these international norms should be. Specifically, the idea that a state can do whatever it wants within its territory and that there should be no questions asked by the rest of the international community. And you can really see them hammering on that point in the case of Xinjiang, Tibet, and most recently, of course, Inner Mongolia. So fascinating points there, Ameya. Aditya, at this point, I'd like to bring you in. Do you have any points that you might like to add?
So, hi, Ameya. Aditya here. What I'd like to ask is, does the nature or the character of the international order matter in terms of how effective international law can be? Is it simpler in a unipolar or a bipolar or a multipolar world? What's the best international system for the enforcement of such international law, if there is one?
Yeah, so this is also something that we took up, because this idea of what kind of polarity is the world heading towards is, I believe, is a common thread in all of the New World Order Project research work. This may seem counterintuitive, but I would argue that a multipolar world is the one which is most conducive to a rules-based international order. So a unipolar world or even a bipolar world is basically a world of two levels of international order, or two classes of international order, if you will, right? So whoever the superpower or the two superpowers are, they sort of operate by one set of rules, and then everybody else operates by another set of rules. This would be most stark in a unipolar world. It would be a little more balanced in a bipolar world, but there would still be these two tiers, as it were. It's in a multipolar world that the benefits of predictability and the incremental influence of an alliance, the fact that if you have a pretext, you can swing an alliance, or you can swing two or three more powers into an alliance than you otherwise could, actually has the most effect or the most play. So both for the smaller states, in terms of how many people's behavior is constrained and how effectively is it constrained, and for the larger states, in terms of how many situations can I actually not have to worry about and therefore focus my resources on just a few of them. It's in a multipolar world that I would expect to see the greatest utility derived from an international legal order. There's an important caveat on this, though, which is that what I'm saying only holds true if the order is reasonably established going into this multipolar scenario. So I should distinguish between, is an international legal order more likely to emerge from such a setup, and where is it likely to be most useful? I'm saying the latter. It's likely to be most useful in a multipolar setup. I'm fascinated by, but I don't have a good answer right now for, could it emerge from a multipolar setup?
Yeah, that is an interesting question. So, I mean, just to be crude about this, if you were to rank them, you'd say multipolar is best, unipolar second, and bipolar is the worst?
No. Unipolar is definitely the worst for a rules-based international order.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
Because it depends on the superpower. Well, so unipolar with that superpower playing benevolent dictator is the best, but...
Okay.
You know, students of political science have little reason to believe that benevolent dictators exist or remain benevolent.
Sure. Okay. The other question over here is then, if that is the situation, if that is the case, what sort of new legal architecture do we need now to cope with the world or possible worlds that might emerge in the coming 25 years?
I don't know that we need a new legal architecture, though. I mean, I would argue that a lot of this is not actually played out in the words of law or institutions per se. So in some ways, the crux of my argument in the chapter is that law is one input or one factor in decisions that are made based on geopolitics, right? That are made based on power and alliance and interest. It can shift the balance of those decisions by increasing the costs of some of them and by decreasing the cost of alliance formation. But it's not a question about the specific form of the legal order. So, I mean, I'm not sure if I've answered the question.
No, you didn't. Yeah.
But off the top of my head, we don't need a new one.
Okay.
Interesting point. So I think on that note, it's time to... With an eye on the future, it's worth asking what India's stance needs to be for the kind of global rules-based system that we see today, given Chinese belligerence on India's border, which is something that we've extensively written about at Takshashila. And we've also extensively showed that very often China's activities have little to no legal foundation whatsoever. The question I think that is worth asking now is whether India should continue to adhere by the rules-based order, or whether there is a case to be made for India to not do that. If you look at India's history over the last few decades, of course, one could very easily say that India tends to be one of the upholders of the international system. It's built up a great deal for credibility, great deal of credibility for itself as a country that takes principal stands and the moral high ground. But there's an increasingly large number of people, especially in Indian social media, for example, who believe that India should not stick to these moral high grounds, that these principles amount to very little on the international sphere, and really doing what China is doing, being more aggressive and being more confrontational in its foreign policy, might really be better for India in the long run. Amir, what are your thoughts on the matter?
Maybe I'll take those in reverse order, right? So for the people who are saying we should adopt a more muscular policy, we should not worry as much about whether this accords with whatever international principles, etc. Show me a path in reality where this actually works. So, you know, if we were at a point in history in which India had a chance of becoming a regional hegemon, maybe I would revisit my stance, right? It might cause me qualms to my conscience, but as a matter of geopolitics, maybe I would revisit my stance and say, yeah, you're being kind of stupid for abiding by these rules. You should be going all out for a power grab. But that's not the world we live in, right? If there was a race for power, we didn't come first. We now have to deal with the fact that we have a neighbor who is substantially more powerful than us, right? So you are looking for tools that will help you in that circumstance. Okay. One of the things that can help you in that circumstance is the idea of a counterbalancing or a containing alliance. If you want to form that kind of counterbalancing or containing alliance, then you have to be a more attractive alliance partner than your rival, because your rival could also form what Stephen Walt calls bandwagoning alliances, where people say, okay, I know who's going to win in this power struggle, and it's better for me to side with them right now. Right? So how do you distinguish yourself from your rival? How does India distinguish itself from China in this case? Right? You distinguish yourself by saying, look, the Chinese version of a world order is in fact Sino-centric. We are seeing excellent evidence that they will assimilate whatever territory they can and then look to assimilate whatever people are within that territory. Right? So in fact, when we wrote the chapter, I used the term cultural genocide with respect to Xinjiang. With the kind of evidence that has come up in recent months, I'm going to drop the term cultural, right? China is engaging in genocide in Xinjiang. There cannot be a more stark illustration of what their attitude towards quote-unquote non-Chinese or to-be-assimilated populations is. So, sure, I'm not saying abide by the principles no matter what, come hell or high water. No, there, real politics is a thing. There will be places in which you will actually place some sort of relatively short-term political gain above the principle. Hopefully, it will still be the kind of political gain that is in the national interest, not the kind of political gain that is in the interest of just one or the other political party or leader. But that said, as the weaker party in this competition, I think that India needs to actually put greater stock into building those institutions and into building alliances that are based on those shared principles and into using those tools so that they can actually be, into creating a set of constraints that while they constrain both us and our rivals, because our rival is the more powerful one, the constraint is far greater for them than it is for us. You are asking me to give up a putative course of action that I probably don't have the ability and the power to take anyway. That's a notional loss.
Yeah.
You are asking them to give up a course of action that they actually can and to some degree are taking. That's not a notional loss. That's a real constraint, right? The other part of your question where you started it, I think, is about the reputation that we have, right? And I think it's worth spending a little bit of time on this because I think a lot of people who would identify as realist or who sort of argue in this real politics style underestimate how much reputation in itself is an asset in international law and international relations and in this sort of formation of principles-based alliances, right? So the way that a country gains a reputation in international law is basically two things. One is consistency. The other is to take actions that are costly, right? I signal my belief in a principle by abiding by it across multiple times and across multiple contexts. And I signal it especially when I do so in a context where breaking the principle offers me some benefit, but I am willing to absorb that cost and stand by the principle, right? Now, whatever your opinion of whether those choices that were made in our history were wise or not, India has chosen to do this. And by doing this, we have actually built up this asset that is this reputation, right? It shows. It shows in the fact that we are able to maintain not just functional but cordial alliances with parties that are not even on speaking or diplomatic terms with each other, right? So 2011 or 12, when I lived for a bit in Delhi, I was staying with an uncle who was in the military. And so I got to like live somewhere in the Chanakyapuri area. And I used to walk around. India is one of the few countries that actually has a Palestinian embassy and an Israeli embassy. Not all that far apart from each other, right? They're not like relegated to completely different parts of the city or anything. India is one of the few countries that has an Israeli and an Iranian embassy. Again, not relegated to like completely different parts of the city, right? We maintain cordial, functional, actively cooperative relationships with Israel, with Iran, with Saudi Arabia, with Egypt. Now, it's not a big deal if the United States is able to do that. Those countries want something from them. Kind of a big deal if India is able to do it, right? That didn't happen overnight. And the fact is that you will never hear any of these countries criticize India for the fact that it maintains those relationships. We voted against Israel in the Human Rights Council. Did Israel object? People in India objected. They were like, this is a bad move. We are taking the side of Palestinians for what? There's no benefit, right? And my reply then and now is, but Israel isn't objecting. They recognize this as part of the diplomatic dance that India engages in. The kind of reputation that we have built up through consistency and through costly actions is an asset that we should not neglect or squander. It gives us a certain form of legitimacy. And in international relations, legitimacy and trust is the currency of negotiation. Slight tangent, but if I can just give you an example to illustrate what I mean by legitimacy. The US election is technically still not over, right? There is December 13th or 14th or whenever when the results are officially declared. Nonetheless, a number of world leaders have had phone calls with Joe Biden to congratulate him and to talk about what they would like to do moving forward. Okay, if you look at how media around the world, including in the US, report on this, the fact that a head of state of another country, of another sovereign state, is calling up this man who currently does not hold any political office and is having those conversations with him, is conferring legitimacy onto the outcome of the US elections. Right? This is the US. They do not need, on one level, the confer of legitimacy on their elections by other states. But nonetheless, they recognize it. And that's exactly the same script that they follow when they report on it as any other country does, right? So we take for granted things like this until they don't happen, right? Imagine if no world leader had called Biden. Suddenly, the degree of certainty that we feel that those election results would be accepted and honored would be a lot lower, right? So there are a lot of things like this that underpin the relationship between states that we don't actually think about because they happen more or less automatically. But we notice them when they don't. That's when we say, hang on, we're not sure if this is a legitimate leader. We're not sure if the relationship between these countries is going to remain intact. The fact that we've been able to establish those sorts of relationships with so many countries is an asset that we should not neglect. And we should really be asking ourselves, if I can sort of come full circle now to where your question ended. We should be asking ourselves, how can we leverage those relationships and that reputation to create the kinds of principles-based alliances that will stand us in good stead in the future, the next time China attempts some kind of territorial aggression against us or against one of the other members of this alliance, because then we will no longer be singled out in our response. We will actually be able to act as part of an alliance. Even if we have not signed a treaty that literally says we have common security interests, we will still have a basis for saying, no, we're going to take action in some other sphere, maybe economic, because we do not trust that China is going to abide by its commitments. Why do we not trust? Well, look at their behavior in this other sphere, whether that's territory, whether that's, as I said, genocide. This stuff is fungible. It, again, reputation is an asset, and reputation is built across multiple domains, and reputation can be leveraged and weaponized across multiple domains.
That was very elegantly put, Ameya, and I think that's definitely a lot of food for thought. It really brings up the question of how exactly India might be undermining its reputation in ways that aren't exactly confined to the international domain, but also to the way that its own democracy is developing and might continue to develop in the years to come. But overall, this has been an absolutely fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for drawing back the curtain and giving us a little peek into how rules and norms guide the way that states act and behave. To all of our listeners, if you enjoyed this podcast, I would highly recommend that you pick up a copy of India's Marathon and read Ameya's excellent chapter. You'll find a link to it in the description of this podcast. Thank you once again, Ameya, for joining us. And thank you for listening to All Things Policy.
Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew. My pleasure.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week, Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.